Welcome to the GBC Sermon Podcast, a weekly podcast from Gymea Baptist Church in Sydney, Australia. I'm Mark Rader, senior pastor here at GBC, and I hope that you hear the invitation of God today. In this week's message, we turn to another follow me passage in John's Gospel, but one with a twist. Instead of an open invitation to follow, Jesus tells his disciples that there are limits placed around our ability to follow him.
Today's Bible reading is from John chapter 13, verses 21 to 28. After he had said this, Jesus was troubled in spirit and testified, "Very truly I tell you, one of you is going to betray me." His disciples stared at one another, at a loss to know which one of them he meant. One of them, the disciple whom Jesus loved, was reclining next to him. Simon Peter motioned to this disciple and asked and said, "Ask him which one he means." Leaning back against Jesus, he asked him, "Lord, who is it?" Jesus answered, "It is the one whom I give this piece of bread when I have dipped it in the dish." Then dipping the piece of bread, he gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. As soon as Judas took the bread, Satan entered into him. So Jesus told him, "What you're about to do, do it quickly." But no one at the meal understood why Jesus said this to him.
We're continuing today our series in John's Gospel. We're looking at the somewhat unique perspective that John brings to following Jesus in this gospel account. And I say somewhat unique because John's gospel does, of course, tell the same story of the same Jesus. It's not as if John's gospel tells a completely and utterly different account, although his emphasis is quite different. So I've mentioned this before, but where the first three gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, focus a lot on Jesus's exorcisms as kind of the typical miracle to demonstrate his authority and to demonstrate his power and to symbolize what his ministry is about, John contains no exorcisms. Where in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus' primary mode of speech is actually parables. He tells lots of little stories that demonstrate the kingdom of heaven. In John's gospel, we don't find any of these parables. Instead, Jesus uses a great deal of metaphorical speech, describing himself as the good shepherd, or as the vine, or as the resurrection, or the life, those kinds of ideas. And even the passages where John tells the same stories are told quite differently. So Jesus cleans the temple. Remember that scene when he comes into the temple and flips over tables and drives people out of a corner of the courtyard? He does that in all four gospel accounts, but John includes that at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, not at the end. There are similar differences in focus when we get to things like the feeding of the 5,000 or when Jesus walks on water or other parallel passages. And so it shouldn't be that surprising that when we come to the account of the Last Supper, when we come to the account of the night that Jesus was betrayed, that we would also find that there are some similarities but also some differences. So starting in John chapter 13, John is recounting for us the events that took place on what we would say is like, I guess, Monday, Thursday, Good Friday, right? It's the night that Jesus was betrayed. But where Matthew, Mark, and Luke focus on the meal, they focus on Jesus taking the bread and breaking it and saying, "This is my body given for you," and taking the cup and saying, "This is my blood given for you." John's focus is different. He begins with Jesus washing the disciples' feet, something that's not found in the other accounts. And then there follows after it a fairly lengthy section of teaching, what scholars commonly refer to as the farewell discourse. So if you have a Bible with red letters where Jesus speaks, you might just notice that starting in chapter 14, basically to the end of chapter 17, it is essentially solid red. Jesus teaches that this on this final evening with his disciples, and this is what John tends to focus upon. But the reason why we're pausing here to reflect a little bit on this familiar scene that opens with the betrayal of Judas being predicted and ends at the end of chapter 13 with the denial of Peter being predicted is because it's in this passage, in this section, that we also find another reference to what it means to follow Jesus. I have been utilizing a book. I've mentioned it a couple of times over the course of this series. It's called The Spirituality of Following Jesus in John's Gospel. It's by a fellow named Sean Kim. It's not a devotional text. It's quite academic in tone, but it's a brilliant analysis of all the various places where John talks about following Jesus and uses the verb to follow. And he points out in this passage that John is the only gospel writer to talk about following Jesus in this context of the Last Supper. So if you have your Bibles with you and want to turn with me to John chapter 13 again, Jesus predicts that Judas will betray him, and this is one of the few references to the meal that's taking place, where Jesus takes some bread, dips it in, and gives it to Judas, and Judas leaves, and it is night. And we're familiar, perhaps, with that scene. But then it goes on in verse 31 to the next part. When he was gone, Jesus said, "Now the Son of Man is glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will glorify the Son in himself and will glorify him at once. My children, I will be with you only a little longer. You will look for me, and just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now, where I am going, you cannot come. A new command I give you, love one another as I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another." Here's the critical piece. Simon Peter asked him, "Lord, where are you going?" And Jesus replied, "Where I am going, you cannot follow now, but you will follow later." That's the reference to following. And it is a curious one, isn't it? Because I think where we've gotten used to the idea of the language of following being very invitational. Come, follow me. The disciples in chapter 1 came after Jesus. They followed after him. He turned to them and said, "What do you want?" They said, "Where are you staying?" He said, "Come and see." The language of following has been very invitational. And here, in this context, Jesus turns to his disciples and says, "You cannot follow now, but you can follow later. You can follow now, but you cannot, you cannot follow now, but you can follow later." And I want to reflect a little bit on what it is that Jesus is saying in this context and what John implies for us as followers of Jesus. And as always, it's helpful to pay attention to the context. So if you follow on from Jesus' statement, Peter then asks a follow-up. He says, "Lord, why can't I follow you now? I will lay down my life for you." Then Jesus answered, "Will you really lay down your life for me? Very truly, I tell you, before the rooster crows, you will disown me 3 times. Now, the first way that we could understand Jesus' distinction between now and later, you cannot follow now, but you can follow later, is to pay attention to simply what Jesus is talking about when he speaks about where he is going. He's been using this language throughout, and it's striking that Jesus, in fact, mentions here that he has already told the Jews this same thing. Now, the Jews, as a title, is given to those who are Jesus' enemies, who have seen the signs that he has done and have rejected him outright. I mean, technically, the disciples were also Jews, right? But Jesus says, "What I have said to my enemies, what I have said to my detractors, what I have said to those who have rejected me, I now say to you, where I am going, you cannot come." And I suppose on the surface, we can then say, well, he's going to his death. And so is this simply a matter of Jesus saying to Peter, "Now is not the time for you to die, you will die later"? Is that all there is? I mean, later in the gospel, after Jesus has been raised to life, Peter has a conversation with Jesus where Jesus actually tells him how he will die. There's a later. But is that all that's going on here? Is this simply a temporal note that Jesus is saying just to Peter, now is not the time for you to die? Well, probably not. I mean, because this is not simply a historical account for us. John wants to draw us into what it looks like to follow Jesus. And on top of that, we already know that Jesus is not just going to his death, is he? It's not like you or I might say, I am going to die. It's not nearly as disturbing as that, because for Jesus, we know that his death is not an ordinary death. From the very beginning of the book, we've been told that Jesus is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. Jesus is about to lay down his life for the sheep. In fact, I think this kind of reference to Jesus' capital D death, right, that his death is very significant, is actually reflected in Peter's comment. Did you notice how Peter frames up his commitment to Jesus? Lord, why can't I follow you now? I will lay down my life for you. Isn't that just horribly ironic? That Peter would think that he is laying down his life for Jesus? Did you hear Jesus' response? Really? Will you really lay down your life for me? It's not how this works. I'm about to lay down my life for all. And it's this kind of big picture, I think, that helps us make some sense of the now and later. Because what Jesus is referring to is not just about kind of a time frame, but about what is going to happen between the now and the later. And there are two really significant components that John will kind of take us through in the passages that follow. One, of course, is Jesus' death. Jesus' death makes an enormous difference in our ability to follow him, does it not? Because his death takes away the sin of the world. It takes away our sin. It enables us to then step into what it means to follow Jesus. And although we don't have time to look at the rest of the farewell discourse, there's another really important event that takes place only if Jesus can leave. And that is that he will send the Spirit. And the Spirit being given to us as the enabling presence, the advocate, the counselor to come alongside of us is equally important for our following, isn't it? That without the Spirit being given to us, we are unable to follow Jesus. And this, I think, is the point that John wants to make. You cannot follow now. You cannot follow now. And it's not just about the timing, it's about the conditions of that following. You are incapable of following me, Jesus says to his disciples. The same thing he said to his enemies, but for completely different reasons. Here's the principle. You and I are no more able to follow Jesus in our own strength or our own conviction or our own will or our own desire than those who have rejected Jesus outright. We are unable to follow Jesus apart from what he does. And if you want kind of clarification around this, just look at the context. This following Jesus statement is tucked between the betrayal of Judas and the denial of Peter. And while Judas and Peter act as their own independent people, making their own decisions with their own outcomes, there's also something representative about them, isn't there? That in each one of us, there may be a little bit of Judas. More interested in the financial benefits than of actually following. More interested in our own vision or version of Jesus than we are in following. To be honest, there's probably more than a little bit of Peter in all of us, isn't there? Very keen desire, but pretty misplaced, with an unbelievable amount of belief in our conviction. I would die for you. Unless a little girl asks me, in which case I will crumble. I Our communion table here at Gaimea has a carving on the front. You've probably seen it. And it was carved by a member of our community of faith a long time ago now. But it depicts that famous scene of the Last Supper that Leonardo da Vinci painted. You're perhaps familiar with the image. Jesus in the middle of the table, kind of looking fairly untroubled. And John leaning against him, and a little bit farther down the table, you have Peter holding a knife and looking very upset, right? It's just kind of chaos. The passage that Da Vinci took as the basis for that painting is actually here in John 13. What he meant to depict was the scene immediately following Jesus' words, "One of you will betray me." What a perfect image for a communion table, wouldn't you say? I mean, in all four gospel accounts, this takes place. That Jesus turns to his closest, those who are most committed, who in any society you could have looked at and said, they have done more to follow after Jesus. They have been as faithful as they possibly could. They are the inner circle. And he turns to the inner circle and he says, "One of you will betray me. One of you will deny me three times, and all of you will desert me. This is my body broken for you." His body was not broken for the inner circle of the already perfect. His blood was not shed for those people who obviously had it all together. His body was broken, his blood was shed for betrayers, deserters, and deniers, like you and me. There is something representative here, isn't there? You cannot follow me now. And what changes is not just time. It's not as if Jesus is saying, "You're not yet mature enough. Peter, you don't know enough yet, but you know, you finish that degree and we'll have a conversation. Tell me when you've read through Isaiah again, and I'll give you a pop quiz, and if you pass that, maybe then." It's not a matter of time. It's a matter of conditions being met. The time is not right for you to be able to follow me. Other things must be done first. And what are those other things? My death, Jesus says, my resurrection, and the sending of my Spirit to enable you. We are unable to follow Jesus in our own strength, in our own understanding, in our own ability. And this shapes both the crisis of faith that we encounter and also shapes how we think about following Jesus. You've heard me say it. Anyone can begin to follow Jesus. I'm blown away by the fact that Jesus never demands that people place their faith in him as the Messiah to start the process. He doesn't give them a pop quiz to see if they know enough to begin to follow him. He doesn't even demand that they change their life to start following him. Just start following me. Spend time with me. And as we grow in our understanding of who Jesus is, and we grow in our understanding of his mission, and we grow in our understanding of his character and his call in our lives, as we grow in our understanding of what it will look like for us to follow him, the places where our lives are going to have to change, the differences in our priorities and values and desires, and all of that sort of stuff, we will come to a point where there will be a crisis of faith. A crisis of faith. But here's what we sometimes do. We come to the crisis of faith where we are asked the question, "Who do you say that I am? Who do you say that Jesus is?" And we come to that crisis of faith and we say, "Well, I believe that you are the Christ, that you are the Son of God, that you are my Savior, that you're my Lord, that you are restoring the world. I believe these things." And we bring alongside of that all the things we've learned about him. "Yes, I believe, and look what I now know." And we bring alongside the things that we have done. "Look how I've changed my life." And our emphasis can so easily be on what we now know and what we have done. And in reality, we are only able to follow Jesus by faith alone. And what is our faith in? It's actually found in chapter 14. Chapter 14 is an unfortunate chapter division as far as I'm concerned, because it suggests that later that evening, Jesus had another thought. But this is directly after he has said, "One of you will betray me. Peter, you will deny me. None of you can follow where I am going. I've basically said the same thing to my enemies." So they're all fairly disturbed at this point in time. And to them, he says, "Do not let your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me." And what are they called to believe? Here it is. "My Father's house has many rooms. If that were not so, would I have told you that I'm going there to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you may also be where I am." Do you notice what changes there? The language of following drops away, and it becomes faith, not that we will be able to follow him, but that he will come back and take us to be with him where he is. Which then reshapes our understanding of what it means to follow Jesus. Because we are not technically, shall I say, following after him, like children might follow after their parents, where Jesus is perpetually turning around and saying, "Hurry up. Come on, put the stick down. What are you doing in the bushes?" Where we're not trying to follow him in our own strength, clambering over obstacles that he's able to leap over easily, kind of slogging through the quagmire of disbelief and doubt that Jesus just strides across like it's water, right? That's not what following after Jesus is about, where we are left to try to struggle after him, trying to follow in his footsteps, but realizing that his stride is so long that we can never get there. That's not the kind of following that John provides for us as a model, because its focus is on what Jesus does in his death, his resurrection, his sending of the Spirit. But before we kind of think, well, if it's not a following after Jesus, then maybe it's a piggyback. That Jesus just says, kind of hop on my back and I'll do all the work. Just hop on and I'll do all the striding. No obstacles will get in our way. We'll just leap over everything. It'll be fantastic. You don't have to pay attention at all to the journey. I will take care of everything. As that's not what following Jesus is like either, is it? I want to return to an image that we used in our last series when we were looking at the discipleship lessons from the opening letters in the book of Revelation. Church at Thyatira talked at in that message about being yoked to Jesus and made the observation that I don't know, I've never been yoked to anything or to anyone. So I know what a yoke looks like, but I have no idea of the experience of being yoked together. And I suggested that perhaps an imperfect image that might be helpful for us is actually the image of a three-legged race. Because while I've never been yoked to anything, I have done a three-legged race. And there's something quite profound about thinking about discipleship and following Jesus as a three-legged race. I'm not following after Jesus, nor is he giving me a piggyback. Jesus has bound himself to me to take me to where he is going, that I might be with him. He has bound his leg to mine. He has put his arm around me. And now we are walking together. We don't follow after Jesus as much as we follow with Jesus. And not only is there profound freedom in knowing that it's ultimately the strength and the balance and the capacity and the holiness and the righteousness of Jesus that matters, it also is this wonderful invitation into giving everything that we have. Because we are required to walk with Jesus. Picture a three-legged race in your mind. It's a church picnic of an age gone by. It's a daddy son, three-legged race, and one uber-competitive father, when the starter pistol goes off, just runs, dragging his child behind him. Apart from encouraging him to do creating safe spaces, you've kind of missed the point, haven't you? When we fall down walking with Jesus, what's his reaction? Is it to say, oh, forget it, I'll just drag you the rest of the way? Or is it instead to help us to our feet, make sure the knots are still bound, to put his arm around us and say, on three, we start with the middle leg. One, two, three. You are unable to follow Jesus. But if we have placed our faith in him, then our faith is that he has come to take us with him. Bound himself to us, put his arm around us, and we are now invited to walk with him. Where is your faith? And will you walk with Jesus this week?
When we place our trust in Jesus, he binds himself to us, and we walk with him to be where he is. On our own, we may not be able to follow him, but in his forgiveness, grace, and mercy, and through the enabling presence of the Spirit, we are able to walk with him. I hope you've been encouraged to walk with Jesus this week. Don't forget, we'd love for you to join us at our Sunday services at gbconline.org.au at 9:30 Australian Eastern Time, or visit our website at gaimiabaptist.org.au for on-site service times. Thanks again for joining us this week, and until next time, God bless.